Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on House of Bush, House of Sod, right after this message. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court is a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if a plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if a carpenter said that? He who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client. Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or his own steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about lawyers. He said, quote, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. It's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed, and a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel, and a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary, a commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can order yours by calling direct 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, on September the 11th, 19 Saudi Arabian citizens hijacked four airliners and crashed them into targets here in the United States. All of these 9/11 participants were Saudis. They weren't Palestinians or Iraqis. So what's the connection between 9/11 and Saudi Arabia? And what's the connection between Saudi Arabia and George Bush? Well, it was the second Wednesday in September 2001, and for Brian Cortez, a desperately ill 21-year-old man in Seattle, Washington, the day that he had so long waited for. 2 years earlier, Cortez had been diagnosed with congestive heart failure, and since then his prognosis had become even worse. He suffered from dilated cardiomyopathy. It's a severe swelling of his heart for which the only permanent solution is a transplant. Cortez had been on the official heart transplant waiting list for months. Now, thanks to an accident in Anchorage, Alaska, an organ was finally available. The transplant team from the University of Washington Medical Center chartered a plane to Alaska to retrieve it as quickly as possible. The human heart can last about 8 hours outside the body before it loses its value as a transplanted organ. That was the length of time that the medical team had to remove it from the victim's body, take it to the Anchorage airport, fly approximately 1,500 miles from Anchorage to Seattle, get it to the University of Washington Medical Center, and then complete the surgery. Sometime around midnight, the medical team boarded a chartered jet and flew back with its precious cargo. They passed over the Gulf of Alaska and the Queen Charlotte Islands and finally Vancouver Island in Canada before they crossed over the 49th parallel and re-entered the United States. But something very unexpected then happened. Suddenly, two Royal Canadian Air Force fighter jets were at the charter plane side. The Canadian military planes then handed it off to the two U.S. Air Force F/A-18 fighter jets, which then forced the jet to land. Less than 24 hours earlier, terrorists had hijacked four airliners in the worst atrocity in American history. They crashed them into the New York Trade Center and one into the Pentagon. Nearly 3,000 people lay dead. America was grounded, and Brian Cortez's new heart was 80 miles short of its destination, and time was running out. Cortez's medical team was not alone in confronting a crisis caused by the shutdown of America's airspace. The terrorist attacks had grounded all commercial and private aviation throughout the entire United States for the first time in American history. Former Vice President Al Gore was stranded in Austria because his flight to the United States was canceled. Former President Bill Clinton was stuck in Australia. Major League Baseball games were postponed. American skies were nearly as empty as they had been when the Wright brothers flew for the first time at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. America was paralyzed by terror, and for 48 hours, virtually no one could fly. No one, that is, except for the Saudis. By the time that Brian Cortez's medical team was grounded, Prince Bandar bin Sultan bin Abdul Aziz, the Saudi Arabian ambassador to the United States, Prince Bandar for short, he was orchestrating the exodus of more than 140 Saudi citizens scattered throughout the United States. And they included members of two families. One was the Royal House of Saud, the family that rules the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and which, thanks to the country's vast oil reserves, was without question the richest family in the world. The other family was the Saud's close friends and allies, the bin Ladens, who, in addition to owning a multi-billion dollar construction conglomerate, had spawned the notorious terrorist Osama bin Laden. At 52, Prince Bandar had long been the most recognizable figure from his country in the United States, widely known as the Arab Gatsby with his trimmed goatee and tailored double-breasted suits. Bandar was the very embodiment of the contradictions inherent in being a modern jet-setting, Western-leaning member of the Royal House of Saud. Profane, flamboyant, and cocksure, Bandar entertained lavishly at his spectacular estates all over the world. Whenever he was safely out of Saudi Arabia and beyond the reach of the puritanical form of Islam that is espoused there, he puckishly flouted Islamic tenets by sipping brandy and smoking Cohiba cigars. And when it came to embracing the culture of the infidel West, Bandar outdid even the most ardent admirers of Western civilization. That was him patrolling the sidelines of the Dallas Cowboys football games with his friend Jerry Jones, the team's owner. To militant Islamic fundamentalists who loathe pro-Western multi-billionaire Saudi royals, no one fit the bill better than Prince Bandar. And yet his guise as playboy of the Western world notwithstanding deep in his bones, Prince Bandar was a key figure in the world of Islam. His father, Defense Minister Prince Sultan, was second in line to the Saudi crown. Bandar was the nephew of King Fahd, the aging Saudi monarch, and the grandson of the late King Abdul Aziz, the founder of modern Saudi Arabia, who initiated his country's historic oil for security friendship with the United States when he met Franklin D. Roosevelt on the USS Quincy in the Suez Canal on the 14th of February, 1945. The enormous royal family in which Bandar played such an important role oversaw two of the most sacred places of Islamic worship, the holy mosques in Medina and Mecca. As a wily international diplomat, Bandar also knew full well just how precarious his family's position was. For decades, the House of Saud had somehow maintained control of Saudi Arabia and the world's richest oil reserves by performing a seemingly untenable balancing act with two parties who had vowed to destroy one another. On the one hand, the House of Saud was an Islamic theocracy whose power grew out of the royal family's alliance with Wahhabi fundamentalism, a strident and puritanical Islamic sect that provided a fertile breeding ground for a global network of terrorists urging a violent jihad against the United States. And on the other hand, the House of Saud's most important ally was the great Satan itself, the United States. Even a cursory examination of the relationship revealed astonishing contradictions. America, the beacon of democracy, was to arm and protect a brutal theocratic monarchy. The United States, sworn defender of Israel, was also the guarantor of security to the guardians of Wahhabi Islam, the fundamentalist religious sect that was one of Israel's and America's mortal enemies. Surprisingly, this fragile relationship had not only endured, but in many ways had been spectacularly successful. In the nearly three decades since the oil embargo of 1973, the United States had bought hundreds of billions of dollars of oil at reasonable prices. During that same period, the Saudis had purchased hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons from the United States. The Saudis had supported the United States on regional security matters in Iran and Iraq and refrained from playing an aggressive role against Israel. Members of the Saudi royal family, including Bandar, became billionaires many times over in the process, quietly turning into some of the most powerful players in the American market, investing hundreds of billions of dollars in equities in the United States. And the price of oil, the eternal bellwether of economic, political, and cultural anxiety in America, had remained low enough that enormous gas-guzzling SUVs had become ubiquitous on U.S. highways. During the Reagan and Clinton eras, the economy literally boomed. Now, the relationship was a coarse weave of money, power, and trust. It had lasted because two foes, militant Islamic fundamentalists in the United States, turned a blind eye to one another. The United States military might have been called the policy, don't ask, don't tell. The Quran had its own version, ask not about things which, if made plain to you, may cause you trouble. But now, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, the ugly seams of the relationship had now been laid bare, because thousands of innocent people had now been killed, and most of the killers were Saudi Arabian citizens, and it was up to Prince Bandar, even the master illusionist, to assure Americans that everything was just fine between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Bandar had always been a smooth operator, but now he and his unflappable demeanor would be tested as never before. Bandar desperately hoped that early reports of the Saudi role had been exaggerated. After all, Al-Qaeda terrorist operatives were known to use false passports. But at 10 p.m. on the evening of September the 12th, about 36 hours after the attack, a very high-ranking CIA official, according to Newsweek magazine, it was probably the CIA director George Tenet, who phoned Bandar at his home and gave him the bad news. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. Afterward, Bandar said, "I felt as if the Twin Towers had just fallen on my head. Public relations had never been more crucial for the Saudis." Bandar swiftly retained PR giant Burson Marsteller to place newspaper ads all over the United States condemning the attacks and disassociating Saudi Arabia from these attacks. He went on CNN and the BBC and the major TV networks and hammered home the same points again and again. The alliance with the United States was still strong. Saudi Arabia would support America in its fight against terrorism. Prince Bandar also protested media reports that referred to those involved in terrorism as Saudis, asserting that no terrorists could ever be described as Saudi citizens. He urged the media and politicians to refrain from casting arbitrary accusations against Arabs and Muslims. "We in the kingdom, the government and the people of Saudi Arabia refused to have any person affiliated with terrorism to be connected to our country," Bandar said, and that included Osama bin Laden, the perpetrator of the attacks, who had even been disowned by his own family. "He was not really a Saudi," Bandar asserted, "for the government had taken away his passport because of his terrorist activities." But Osama bin Laden was a Saudi, of course, and he was not just any Saudi. The bin Ladens were one of a handful of extremely wealthy families that were so close to the House of Saud that they effectively acted as extensions of the royal family. Over five decades, they had built their multi-billion dollar construction empire thanks to their intimate relationship with the royal family. Prince Bandar himself knew them well. "They're really lovely human beings," he told CNN. "Osama is the only one. I met him only once," Bandar said. "The rest of them are all well-educated, successful businessmen involved in a lot of charities. It is tragic. I feel pain for them because he has caused them so much pain." Like Bandar, the bin Laden family epitomized the marriage between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Their huge construction company, the Saudi bin Laden Group, banked with Citigroup and invested with Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch. Over time, the bin Ladens did business with such icons of Western culture as Disney, the Hard Rock Cafe, Snapple, and Porsche. In the mid-90s, they joined various members of the House of Saud in becoming business associates with former Secretary of State James Baker and former President George Herbert Walker Bush by investing in the Carlyle Group, a gigantic Washington, D.C.-based private equity firm. As Charles Freeman, the former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, told the Wall Street Journal, "If there were ever any company closely connected to the United States and its presence in Saudi Arabia, it is the Saudi bin Laden Group." The bin Ladens and members of the House of Saud who spent time in the United States were mostly young professionals and students attending high school or college. Many lived in the Boston area, and thanks to its high concentration of colleges, Abdullah bin Laden, a younger brother of Osama's, was a 1994 graduate of the Harvard Law School and had offices in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Several bin Ladens had attended Tufts University near Boston. Sana bin Laden had graduated from Wheelock College in Boston and organized a Saudi festival at the Children's Museum in Boston. Two bin Ladens, Muhammad and Nuaf, owned units in the flagship Wharf Condominium Complex in Charlestown Navy Yard in Boston Harbor. Some of the young, chic, sophisticated members of the family appeared even more westernized than Bandar. Wafa bin Laden, a 26-year-old graduate of Columbia Law School, lived in a $6,000 a month rented loft in New York's fashionable Soho and was considered pursuing a singing career. Partial to Manhattan night spots such as Lotus, the Mercer Kitchen, and Pravda, she was in Geneva, Switzerland at the time of the attack and simply did not return. Cameron bin Laden, a cousin of Osama's in his 30s, also frequented Manhattan night spots and spent as much as $30,000 in one day on designer clothes at Prada's Fifth Avenue boutique. He elected to stay in the United States. But half-brother Khalil bin Laden wanted to go back to Jeddah. Khalil, who had a Brazilian wife, had been appointed as Brazil's honorary consul in Jeddah and owned a sprawling 20-acre estate in Winter Garden, Florida, near Orlando. As for the Saudi royal family, many of them were scattered all over the United States, and some had gone to Lexington, Kentucky for the annual September yearling auctions. The sale of the finest racehorses in the world had been suspended after the terrorist attacks on September the 11th, but resumed the very next day. Saudi Prince Ahmed bin Salman bought two horses for $1.2 million on September the 12th. Others felt more personally threatened. Shortly after the attack, one of the bin Ladens, an unnamed brother of Osama's, frantically called the Saudi embassy in Washington seeking protection. He was given a room at the Watergate Hotel and told not to open his door. King Fahd, the aging and infirm Saudi monarch, sent a message to his emissaries in Washington. It said, "Take measures to protect the innocents," he said. Meanwhile, a Saudi prince sent a directive to the Tampa Police Department in Florida that young Saudis who were close to the royal family and went to school in the area were in potential danger. Bander then went to work immediately. If any foreign official had the clout to pull strings at the White House in the midst of a grave national security crisis, it was Prince Bander. A senior member of the Washington Diplomatic Corps, Bander played racquetball with Secretary of State Colin Powell in the late 70s. He had run covert operations for the late CIA director Bill Casey that were so hush-hush that they were kept secret even from President Ronald Reagan. He was the man who had stashed away 30 locked attaché cases that held some of the deepest secrets in the intelligence world. And for two decades, Bander had built an intimate personal relationship with the Bush family and went far beyond a mere political friendship. First, Prince Bander set up a hotline at the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. for all Saudi nationals in the United States. For the 48 hours after the attacks, he stayed in constant contact with the Secretary of State Colin Powell and the National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. Before the attacks, Bander had been invited to come to the White House to meet with President George W. Bush on September the 13th to discuss the Middle East peace process. Even though the 55-year-old president and he were, roughly speaking, contemporaries, Bander had not yet developed the same rapport with the younger Bush that he'd enjoyed for decades with his father. Bander and the elder Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, had participated in the shared rituals of manhood, such as hunting trips, vacations together, and the like. Bander and the young Bush were well known to each other, but not nearly as close. On the 13th, the meeting went ahead as scheduled, but in the wake of the attacks 2 days earlier, the political landscape of the Middle East had now drastically changed. The spokesman for the Saudi embassy later said that he did not know whether repatriation was a topic of discussion, but the job had been started nonetheless. And earlier that same day, a 49-year-old former policeman turned private investigator named Dan Grossi got a call from Tampa, Florida Police Department. Grossi had worked with the Tampa police force for 20 years before retiring, and it was not particularly unusual for the police to recommend former police officers for special security jobs. But Grossi's new assignment was very much out of the ordinary. The police had been giving Saudi students protection since September the 11th. They asked if I was interested in escorting these students from Tampa to Lexington, Kentucky, because the police department simply couldn't do it. Grossi was told to go to the airport, where a small charter jet would be available to take him and the Saudis on that flight. He was not given a specific time of departure, and he was dubious about the prospects of accomplishing his task. Quite frankly, I knew that everything was grounded. He says, "I never thought this was going to happen." Even so, Grossi, who'd been asked to bring a colleague, phoned Manuel Perez, a former FBI agent, to put him on alert. Perez was equally unconvinced. "I said, forget about it," Perez recalls. "Nobody is flying today." The two men had good reason to be skeptical. Within minutes of the terrorist attacks on 9/11, the Federal Aviation Administration had sent out a special notification, which is called a NOTAM, a notice to airmen, to airports all across America, ordering every airborne plane in the United States to land at the nearest airport as soon as possible, and prohibiting planes on the ground from taking off. Initially, there were no exceptions whatsoever. Later, when the situation stabilized, several airports accepted flights for emergency medical and military operations, but those were few and far between. Nevertheless, at 1:30 on the 13th, Dan Grossi received his phone call. He was told that the Saudis would be delivered to Raytheon Airport Services, a private hangar at the Tampa International Airport. When he arrived, Manny Perez was there to greet him. And at the terminal, a woman laughed at Grossi for even thinking that he would be flying that day. Commercial flights had slowly begun to resume, but at 10:57 a.m., the FAA had issued another notice, a reminder that private aviation was still prohibited. Three private planes violated the ban that day in Maryland, West Virginia, and Texas, and in each case, a pair of jet fighters quickly forced the aircraft to land. As far as private planes were concerned, America was still grounded. Then one of the pilots arrived. "Here's your plane," he told Grassi, "whenever you're ready to go." What happened next was first reported by Kathy Steele and Elizabeth Lee Brown in the Tampa Tribune in October of 2001. Not a single other American paper seemed to think the subject was newsworthy. Grassi and Perez say they waited until three young Saudi men, all apparently in their early 20s, arrived. Then the pilot took Grassi, Perez, and the Saudis to a well-appointed 10-passenger Learjet. They departed for Lexington, Kentucky at about 4:30 that afternoon. "They got the approval somewhere," said Perez. "It must have come from the highest levels of the U.S. government." Flight instructions had not been lifted yet. "Yeah, I was told that it would take the White House and White House approval. I thought the flight was not going to happen." Grassi said he did not get the names of the Saudi students that he was escorting. "It happened so fast." Grassi says, "I just knew that there were Saudis. They were well connected, and one of them told me that his father or his uncle was good friends with President George Bush." How did the Saudis go about getting approval? According to the Federal Aviation Administration, they didn't, and the Tampa flight never took place. "It's not in our logs," Chris White, a spokesman for the FAA, told the Tampa Tribune. "It didn't occur." The White House also said that the flights to evacuate the Saudis did not take place. Well, hang on. We'll be back with more on the Saudi Connection right after this. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. The school includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, citation, or a complaint. Now, rule number one is, don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut, and then shut up. If you can learn rule one, you can win about 90% of your legal cases, and that's because all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And your government is fully capable of making their own case without any help from you whatsoever. Listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation, and indeed, in many cases, police intimidation. The first judge put it this way. He said, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" He said that in U.S. versus Dickerson. The second judge said, "You can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment in Belknap versus United States." And the third judge said, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the far-sighted," in Marchetti versus United States. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. And while you're at it, be sure to ask for my free general law CD training package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, click on the email, and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct. 417-273-4967. Tonight's report comes from House of Bush, House of Sod, written by Craig Unger. It's copyrighted in 2004 by Schribner. The ISBN number is 0-7432-5337-X. I rated about a 1 in 100 book. It'll be a long time before you read another one like this. I'm going to give you the highlights of the background of the Saudi Arabian and the House of Bush connections. Craig Unger has done a magnificent job in this portrayal of the connecting link between the Saudis, the Bushes, and 9/11. Now, George Bush has been reelected president for the next 4 years. Therefore, we can expect more of the same, a special relationship that exists between the Bushes and the Saudis, a relationship that we've never heard about before Craig Unger and his book, The House of Bush, House of Saud. The price is $26 American, $39 Canadian. You Canadians up there, $39. Americans, $26. You can probably pick up a copy at Barnes & Noble. Going on, according to Grassi, about 1 hour and 45 minutes after they took off from Orlando, Florida, they landed at the Bluegrass Airport at Lexington, Kentucky. That's a frequent destination for Saudi racehorse enthusiasts such as Prince Ahmed bin Salman. When they arrived, the Saudis were greeted by an American who took custody of them and helped them with their luggage. On the tarmac was a 747 with Arabic writing on the fuselage, apparently ready to take them all back to Saudi Arabia. My understanding is that there were other Saudis in Kentucky buying racehorses at the same time, and they were going to all fly back together, said Grassi. With just three Saudis on it, the Tampa flight was hardly the only mysterious trip underway. All over the United States, members of the extended Bin Laden family and the House of Saud and their associates were assembling in various locations. At least seven other airplanes were available for their transportation. Officially, the FBI says that it had nothing to do with the repatriation of the Saudis. I can say unequivocally that the FBI had no role in facilitating these flights one way or another, says Special Agent John Iannarelli. Prince Bender, however, characterized the role of the FBI very differently. With coordination with the FBI, he said on CNN, we got them all out. Meanwhile, the Saudis had at least two of the planes on call to repatriate the Bin Ladens. One of them began picking up family members all across the United States, starting in Los Angeles. On an undetermined date, it flew first to Orlando, Florida, where Khalil Bin Laden, a sibling of Osama Bin Laden, boarded and left from Orlando. The plane then continued on to Dulles International Airport outside Washington before going on to Logan Airport in Boston on September the 19th, picking up members of the Bin Laden family all along the way. As the planes prepared for takeoff at each location across the United States, the FBI repeatedly got into disputes with Rehab Mossad Bender's charged affairs at the Saudi Embassy in Washington. And I recall getting into a big flap with Bender's office about whether they would leave without us knowing who was on the plane, said one former agent of the FBI who participated in the repatriation of the Saudis. Bander wanted the plane to take off, and we were stressing that that plane was not leaving until we knew exactly who was on it. In the end, the FBI was only able to check papers and identify everyone on the flights. In the past, the FBI had been constrained from arbitrarily launching investigations without a predicate, for example, a strong reason to believe that an individual had been engaged in criminal activities. Spokesmen for the FBI assert that the Saudis had every right to leave the country. Meanwhile, President George Bush was in Washington working full-time at the White House to mobilize a global anti-terror coalition. On Friday, September the 14th, a dozen ambassadors from Arab nations, Syria, the Palestinian Authority, Algeria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and the Persian Gulf states met at the Prince Bender home in McLean, Virginia to discuss how they would respond to President Bush's new policies. Bander himself had pledged his support for the war on terror, and perhaps most importantly, he vowed that Saudi Arabia would help stabilize the world oil markets. In a breathtaking display of their command over the oil markets, the Saudis dispatched 9 million barrels of oil to the United States. As a consequence, the price instantly dropped from $28 to $22 a barrel. On Tuesday, September the 18th, at Logan Airport, a specially reconfigured Boeing 727 with about 30 first-class seats had been chartered by the Bin Laden family and flew five passengers, all of them members of the Bin Laden family, out of the United States from Boston. The next day, September the 19th, President Bush met with the president of Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim country, and with the foreign ministers of Russia and Germany. His speech-writing team was also working on a stirring speech to be delivered the next day, officially declaring a global war on terror. Our war on terror will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated, President Bush vowed. Meanwhile, the plane that had originated in Los Angeles and gone to Orlando, Florida, then on to Washington, D.C., another Boeing 727, was due to touch down at Boston's Logan International Airport. At the time, Logan was in chaos. The two hijacked planes that had crashed into the World Trade Center's Twin Towers had departed from Logan. The airport was reeling from criticism that its security failures had allowed the hijackings to take place. And exceptional measures were now being taken to correct that problem. Several thousand cars were towed from the airport's parking garages. We didn't know if they were booby-trapped or what, said Tom Kenton. He was the director of aviation at the Logan Airport. Even though the Federal Aviation Administration had allowed commercial flights to resume on September 13th because of various security issues, the Logan Airport did not reopen until September the 15th. 2 days later, even then, air traffic resumed slowly. Then in the early afternoon of September the 19th, a call came into Logan's Emergency Operations Center saying that the private charter aircraft was going to pick up members of the Bin Laden family. Both Kenton and Virginia Buckingham, the head of the Massachusetts Port Authority, which oversees the Logan Airport, were absolutely incredulous. We were in the midst of the worst terrorist act in history, Kenton said, and here we were seeing an evacuation of the Bin Ladens from the United States. Now, like Kenton, Virginia Buckingham was stunned that the Bin Laden family was being spirited out of the United States. My staff was told that a private jet was arriving at the Logan Airport from Saudi Arabia to pick up 14 members of Osama Bin Laden's family living in the Boston area, she later wrote, and it was published in the Boston Globe. Does the FBI know? Staffers wondered. Does the State Department know? Why are they letting these people out of the United States without even questioning them? Have they been questioned? This was absolutely ridiculous. Yet, there was little that Logan officials could do. Federal law did not give them much leeway in terms of restricting an individual flight, so bravado would have to do in the place of true authority, wrote Buckingham. So again and again, Tom Kenton asked for official word from the FBI. Tell the tower, that plane is not coming in here until somebody in Washington tells us it's okay, he said. As the bin Ladens were about to land, the top brass at Logan Airport did not know what was going on. The FBI's counterterrorism unit should have been a leading force in the domestic battle against terror, but here it was, not even going to interview these Saudis who were about to leave the United States. And each time, Buckingham wrote, the answer was the same, let them leave. On September 19th, under the cover of darkness, they left. And of course, the vast majority of the Saudis on those planes had nothing whatsoever to do with Osama bin Laden. The bin Laden family itself had expressed the strongest denunciation and condemnation of this sad event, which resulted in the loss of so many innocent men, women, and children, and which contradicts our Islamic faith. And a persuasive case could be made that it was against the interests of the royal family and the bin Ladens to have aided the terrorists. But on the other hand, there was the biggest crime in American history. A global manhunt of unprecedented proportions was underway. Thousands of people had just been killed by Osama bin Laden. Didn't it just make sense to at least interview his relatives and other Saudis who, inadvertently or not, may have aided him or could have aided the FBI or the police in solving this crime? Moreover, Attorney General John Ashcroft had asserted that the government had a responsibility to use every legal means at our disposal to prevent further terrorist activity by taking people into custody who have violated the law and who may pose a threat to America. All over the country, Arabs were being rounded up and interrogated. By the weekend after the attacks, Ashcroft, to the dismay of civil libertarians everywhere, had already put together a package of proposals broadening the FBI's power to detain foreigners, wiretap and trace money, and money laundering to these terrorists. Some suspects would be held for as long as 10 months at the naval station at Guantanamo, Cuba. In an ordinary murder investigation, it is commonplace to interview relatives of the prime suspect. When the FBI talks to subjects during an investigation, the questioning falls into one of two categories. Friendly subjects are interviewed, and suspects or unfriendly subjects are interrogated. How did the Saudis get a free pass? And did a simple disclaimer from the bin Laden family mean that no one in the entire family had any contacts or useful information whatsoever? Did that mean that the FBI should simply drop all further inquiries of the bin Ladens? At the very least, wouldn't family members be able to provide U.S. investigators with some useful information about Osama's finances, or the people who might know him, or know about him, or know where he was, or might be aiding him or al-Qaeda? Moreover, national security experts found it was hard to believe that no one in the entire extended bin Laden family had any contact whatsoever with Osama. There is no reason to think that every single member of his family had shut him out. Well, Vincent Canestrero, a former CIA counterterrorism chief, told the New Yorker, "I've been following the bin Ladens for many years, and it's easy to say we disown him. And many in the family have. But blood is usually thicker than water. In fact, Osama bin Laden was not the only bin Laden who had ties to militant Islamic fundamentalists. As early as 1979, Maurice bin Laden, an older half-brother of Osama's, had befriended members of the militant Muslim Brotherhood and had perhaps unwittingly played a key role in a violent armed uprising against the House of Saud in Mecca in 1979, which resulted in more than 100 deaths. Another bin Laden relative, Osama's brother-in-law, Mohammed Jamal Khalifa, was widely reported to be an important figure in al-Qaeda and was tied to the men behind the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and the October 2000 bombing of the USS Cole, and was alleged to have funded a Philippine terrorist group. Khalil bin Laden, who boarded the plane in Orlando to leave the United States, won the attention of Brazilian investigators for possible terrorist connections in Brazil. According to the German wire service Deutsche Press Agentur, he had business connections in the Brazilian state of Minas Gerais and visited its capital. And he was allegedly involved in a center for training terrorists, including members of the Hezbollah movement in Palestine. Now, how is it possible that Saudis were allowed to fly, even when all of America, FBI agents included, had been grounded? And had the White House approved the operation? And if so, why? When Prince Bandar arrived at the White House on Thursday, September the 13th, 2001, he and President Bush retreated to the Truman Balcony, a casual outdoor spot behind the pillars of the South Portico that also provided a bit of privacy. Now, over the years, any history made on the Truman Balcony had transpired in informal conversation. In 1992, 9 years earlier, President Bush's father, George H.W. Bush had walked out on the balcony with Boris Yeltsin, the first democratically elected president of Russia, to celebrate the end of the Cold War. In 1993, after First Lady Hillary Clinton put an end to smoking in the White House, Bill Clinton would sometimes retreat there to smoke a cigar in a celebratory moment, as he did after the United States rescued a soldier in Bosnia. This occasion may have marked the beginning of a new era, but Bandar and President Bush had nothing to celebrate. Thousands of Americans were dead. They had been killed in a terrorist operation largely run by Saudis. Nonetheless, the two men each lit up a Cohiba cigar and began to discuss how they would work together in the war on terror. Bush said that the United States would hand over any captured Al-Qaeda operatives to the Saudis if they would not cooperate. The implication was clear. The Saudis could use any means, including torture, to get the suspects to talk. But the larger points went unspoken. The two men were scions of the most powerful dynasties in the world. The Bush family and its close associates, the House of Bush, if you will, included two presidents of the United States. Former Secretary of State James Baker, who had been a powerful figure in four presidential administrations. Key figures in the oil and defense industries, the Carlyle Group and the Republican Party, and much, much more. As for Bandar, his family effectively was the government of Saudi Arabia, the most powerful country in the Arab world, and they had hundreds of billions of dollars and the biggest oil reserves in the world. The relationship was unprecedented. Never before in history had a president of the United States, much less two presidents from the same family, had such close personal and financial ties to the ruling family of another foreign power. And yet few Americans have realized that these two dynasties, the Bush family and the House of Saud, had a history dating back more than 20 years, not just business partners and personal friends. The Bushes and the Saudis had pulled off elaborate covert operations and had gone to war together. They had shared secrets that involved unimaginable personal wealth, spectacular military might, the richest energy resources in the world, and the most odious crimes imaginable. They had been involved in the Iran-Contra scandal and the secret U.S. aid in the Afghanistan war that gave birth to Osama bin Laden. Along with then-Vice President Bush, the Saudis had joined the United States in supporting the brutal Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein for 7 years after knowing that he had used weapons of mass destruction. In the private sector, the Saudis had supported George W. Bush's struggling oil company, Harkin Energy, and in the 90s, they made common cause with his father by investing in the Carlyle Group. In the 1991 Gulf War, the Saudis and the elder Bush had fought side by side, and now there was the repatriation of the bin Ladens, which could not have taken place without the personal approval at the highest levels of the executive branch of President George W. Bush's administration. Only Bush and Bandar know what transpired that day on the Truman balcony. But the ties between these two families are so strong that allowing the Saudis to leave America would not have been difficult for Bush. It would also have been in character with a relationship in which decisions were often made through elaborate and contrived deniability mechanisms that allowed the principals to turn a blind eye to unseemly realities and to be intentionally out of the loop. The ties between these two families are an open secret that in some ways was an obvious or as obvious as the proverbial elephant in the living room. Yet at the same time, it was somehow hard to discern even for the most seasoned journalists. Perhaps that was because the relationship had been forged all over the world and arced across different areas, from the Reagan-Bush years to the Clinton administration to the presidency of George W. Bush. And to understand its scope and its meaning, you would have to search through tens of thousands of forgotten newspaper stories, read scores of books by journalists and historians, and study the myriad secret classified documents and the records of barely remembered congressional probes of corporate intrigue and Byzantine government scandals. You'd have to journey back in time to the birth of Al-Qaeda at the terrorist training camps during the Afghanistan War. One would have to study the Iran-Iraq War of the 80s, the 1991 Gulf War, and the Iraq War of 2003. One would have to try to deduce what would happen within the corporate suites of oil barons in Dallas and Houston, Texas, and in the executive offices of the Carlyle Group, in the Situation Room at the White House, and in the grand oil palaces of Saudi billionaires. One would have to interview scores of politicians, oil executives, counterterrorism analysts, the CIA operatives, and businessmen from Washington and Saudi Arabia and Texas. You would have to decipher brilliantly hidden agendas and purposefully murky corporate relationships. And finally, you'd have to put all of this information together to shape a continuum, a narrative in which the House of Bush and the House of Saud dominated the world stage together in one era after another. Having done so, you would come to a single, singular, inescapable conclusion, and that is, namely, that horrifying as it may sound, The secret relationship between these two great families helped to trigger the Age of Terror and gave rise to the tragedy of 9/11. This is a report from House of Bush, House of Saud, written by Craig Unger. I rate it a 1 in 100 book. The price is $26 U.S., $39 Canadian. Published by Scribner & Company. Copyright 2004. The ISBN number is 0-7432-5337-X. Let me give you that name and address once more. Published by Scribner & Company. Copyrighted 2004. Written by Craig Unger. Title, House of Bush, House of Saud. The ISBN number 0-7432-5337-X. It's a 1 in 100 read. You've never read anything like it. Now I'm about out of time. We got a couple of minutes left. Let me introduce you to the Houston Jetta connection. It was on a warm night in 2002. James R. Bath, a little-known Texas businessman, opened the door to the front of his ranch in Liberty, a town of 8,000 people on the Trinity River outside Houston, Texas. His house is framed by trees, silhouetted against a moonlit Texas sky. He's about 6 foot tall, trim and balding. Bath mingles a wry, folksy Texas charm with some of the macho of a veteran jet fighter pilot. The combination has served him well in cultivating relationships with some of the great Texas power brokers of the last generation, from former Governor John Connally to the Bush family. And that's where we'll take it up next time, the Houston Jetta connection. All right, The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective, and we do that 7 days a week. The sources of information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. Now, The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend the books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give does not necessarily mean that the authors or the publications that we recommend or endorse will reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, or sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans who do not necessarily endorse the opinions or beliefs expressed here on the Law Hour and editorial review. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour and editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, my time's about up. I'm going to have to leave it right here. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.